Welcome. I think we will start our hearing. I'm Howard Swenson. I'm chairman of the Ag Policy Committee and House Representatives. And our meeting today is to discuss soybeans. As you all know, soybeans are the second largest crop grown in Minnesota. It's a crop that has a big impact on the agriculture sector and the economy of Minnesota. We also know that the past year or two there's been a lot of problems developing with soybeans, some disease programs or problems. Also this past year we had the aphids so we just thought we would have a hearing to have some discussion on this and get some perspective from some people that work in the soybean industry and see what they can tell us on what the future might be or what the research is developing in the soybean area. So I'm welcome to all who came today. We have some of our committee members didn't all make it today, but I think what I'm going to do, I'm going to ask the committee members that are here to just introduce themselves and tell you what part of the state they come from or their home area is. I don't want them to go into any lengthy dialogue because we have a full agenda and we want to try and get through in about 2 hours. But I also want to say that we are in Representative Magnus's district, and so I'll ask him to introduce himself first, and then we'll have Mary Ellen go to the next.
Thank you, Chairman Swenson. Most of you here know me, Doug Magnus. I actually farm about 12 miles south of right where we're at here. And I do welcome all of you here, especially the fellow committee members to Slayton and to the southwest Minnesota area. There's a couple reasons why I asked Howard if we could meet here, and that is I wanted you to see what a pretty area it is. We do have a nice campground here. Hotel next door. We have a nice state park with a lot of camping there. And so this summer, when you get some time off, bring your checkbook and the family and come back down here and spend some money. We need it. Thank you.
I'm Representative Mary Ellen Otremba, and I live on a farm near Long Prairie, Minnesota, which is in the middle of the state. It's about a 3.5-hour drive from here.
Hello, I'm Representative Elaine Harder. My home is at Jackson. I chair the Agriculture and Rural Development Finance Committee.
I'm Representative Al Junkie from Wilmer. I'm the lead Democrat on the Ag Finance Committee. And Howard Swenson told me this meeting was about pickles, and that's why I came, and I know it was about soybeans. So you got me here, though.
Maybe another day.
All right.
just go down the line there and introduce.
Okay, thank you, right. Thank you. I'm State Representative Aaron Peterson. I represent five counties north and west of Representative Magnus's district, starting with Lincoln County in the south and going up to the top of Big Stone County and then over towards Wilmer, where Representative Junkie represents. This is my first term in the House. Thank you.
I'm Doug Lindgren, and my district is up by Bemidji. I live just north of Itasca State Park, and we have, as a matter of fact, we have soybeans just right off to the west of us, starting by Boston in that area.
Perfect timing.
Yes.
You guys think this was church or something?
Yeah. Sit in the back.
The people in the front are easy to please.
Yes. I'm Representative Dean Erdahl, and my district is 18B, which is all but two townships of Meeker County and six townships of Wright County.
I'm Lyle Coonan, and I'm from Maynard, and I represent District 20B, which includes Chippewa County, Redville County, and Eastern Yellow Medicine County.
I'm David Dill. I'm from the Representative Dill, and I'm from the Minnesota Arrowhead. I represent all of the Minnesota Arrowhead. We have no soybeans or corn there, but I do know something about farming. I have a grain farm, irrigated grain farm in Kearney, Nebraska. A little bit about farming. Not much.
So thank you, and I guess, I don't think I said where I was from. I'm from Nicklet, Minnesota. My district is Nicklet and Sibley Counties, east of here. With that, thank you. And I don't know if you all have an agenda or not, but the first person we're going to have some comments from is Ron Jacobson, who is president of the Minnesota Soybean Association. We'd ask the speakers to come up to the podium we have behind us.
Good afternoon. I'm Ron Jacobson, president of the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association. I'd like to thank Representative Howard Swenson for calling this listening session to discuss soybean diseases and pests and to discuss what can be done to reduce crop loss. This past year, it has been estimated that soybean farmers lost close to $500 million due to soybean pests and diseases. As a soybean farmer from Wells, Minnesota, I know firsthand the devastating effects that soybean diseases and pests can have on my crop. In my area, an average of 10 bushels an acre were lost in aphids if they were untreated. Across the state, Minnesota farmers lost between $120 and $150 million because of aphid infestation. Other losses statewide, from iron chlorosis, $75 million. Root rot, $107 million. Seedling diseases, $25 million. Phosphorus deficiency, $75 million. Stem diseases, $40 million. Soybean cyst nematode, $75 million. And grain quality, $30 to $35 million. When you add the dollar loss from aphids, that brings the total to almost $500 million in lost revenue to the state soybean farmers. Research is the key in helping manage or wipe out these profit-robbing problems. With over 308 million bushels produced in 2002, soybeans consistently ranked as one of Minnesota's top three commodities, accounting for $1.6 billion in cash receipts. Imagine if we could increase that amount by $500 million. That is why continued research is absolutely critical if Minnesota soybeans are to remain competitive in the domestic world marketplace, and if Minnesota soybean farmers are to remain profitable. Over the past 5 years, soybean farmers themselves, through the National Checkoff, have invested over $6 million in research projects to add to address the soybean disease and pest. Included in this research is the varying development of molecular market technology. In the 1999 Minnesota legislature approved $900,000 for soybean research initiative that was carried out by the University of Minnesota. It was very much appreciated and was a very good start, but there's much more to be done. I understand the tight budgets the legislature is dealing with, but I urge lawmakers to continue the funding of soybean research in order to protect the state's multi-billion dollar industry. Thank you in advance for your efforts. I would also like to thank University of Minnesota and especially Dean Muscatawat and Deb Durgan for their recent commitment to fill the soybean plant pathologist position. Working together, the state soybean farmers, the legislature, and the University of Minnesota can improve the quality of soybeans and protect soybean farmers from loss caused by soybean disease and pests. Thank you again, Representative Swenson, for hosting this listening session. Better plants with improved protein and oil content, more resistance to disease and pests, and more competitive yield will help Minnesota soybean farmers improve their profitability and meet the growing demand for the marketplace. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobson. I think I'm hoping that before the end of the meeting that we will have some time for some questions or comments from the audience, but I think we'll probably just go through the presentations first. We have several presentations, and I'm hoping to conclude this in about 2 hours' time so that people can get on the road to be going on. So I think we'll just go through the our presenters, and then if we have some time left at the end, we can have some reaction from the audience and the committee members. Our next speaker is Dr. Sanyu Chen from the University of Minnesota, who will talk about the soybean cysts.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the House Committee to invite me to present about the soybean cyst nematode. I'm very pleased to have this opportunity to talk about the soybean cyst nematode situation in Minnesota. I got did a brainstorm last night and
this morning. So, what should I to tell you about the soybean
cyst nematode? And I list here six questions about the soybean cyst nematode. But if you have some questions, other questions concerning the soybean cyst nematode, try to create. I'm not sure whether you are familiar with the soybean cyst nematode or not. So, I start with basic question, what is the soybean cyst nematode? And then I will talk about the distribution of the nematode and the importance of the nematode, and then why the soybean cyst nematode is so important. Why the soybean cyst nematode is a big problem in Minnesota, and then I will talk about the available solutions now, and then I want to discuss the trends of the problem, what's the future of this problem, and then I will talk a little bit about the research needs for the soybean cyst nematode. I planned to about 15 minutes, but Mary said that probably I'd be shortened, and I try to be brief as possible. So let's start with the second slide. Well, soybean cyst nematode, I just wanted to tell you simply, is a worm that feeds on the soybean roots and can cause destroy soybean roots, then that cause that stunting and chlorotic symptom. So this nematode is very pathogenic and causes a lot of damage to the soybean. Now, what is the infestation of this nematode in Minnesota? I just wanted to show you this map. This is the counties that has that have been found the infestation. So far, there is 52 counties in this southern and the central Minnesota that have been infested by the soybean cyst nematode. The soybean cyst nematode now is spreading towards the northern counties, and we now have some county in the Red River Valley, including the Travis County. Recently, the nematode has been found in North Dakota. So it is now in the Red River Valley. Although during the last 3 years, we did not find any additional county infested by the soybean cyst nematode. The possibility of infestation of the nematode in this area in Red River Valley is very high. Now, this nematode is very significant pest of the soybean. It's the number one pathogen of soybean. This, I just wanted to cite the information from the University of Missouri. This estimation of the soybean yield loss
to the soybean diseases in the United States. We can see that most of yield loss to the diseases was attributed to the soybean city nematode. That is about 46% of the total yield loss to disease was caused by the soybean city nematode during 1970s, United States to 2002. A total of yield loss was about 188 million bushels in the United States, loss caused by the soybean city nematode. If you count the calculator to dollars, is about more than $1 billion in the United States every year. If we say that price is $6 per bushel. And this nematode, the other important diseases like Phytophthora and the sudden death syndrome and Kakol, what all these diseases also have been found in Minnesota. But this, the yield loss estimation is very wrong. It's based on a number of scientists' estimation and the average. This is what we, the data we got. For the accurate estimation of the soybean yield loss to the soybean system nematode or other disease is very difficult. But we can get the yield loss in the single field by doing some plot research. This is a data obtained in at Lampeter in 1998, and we can see the yield was significantly reduced by the nematode population density. If the nematode egg density was that high, the yield almost as nothing. So based on the, this research data from the field, and also based on the sample, soil samples from farmers, and what's the number in the soil, in the different soil samples, and we can estimate the yield loss to about 6% in Minnesota. If you base a soil sample, if there's a different method, the results will be different. This is the soil sample from the Minnesota Department, Ag Department survey. And if based on this data, and we can estimate about 3.6% yield loss. That is estimated about $60 million annual yield loss. And if you based on this, probably is about $100 million every year. So it's probably is about between this range, and also the yield loss is based on what the definition of what is the yield loss compared to what. And if you look at this, if we look at this data, the variety trials obtained in 1998 to 2003, we can see the soybean yield of resistant cultivars, all these resistant cultivars, was significantly lower in the non-infested field site than in infested site. These results was consistently observed during these years. That maybe the this different field, the soil fertility are different, but this difference is consistently observed during these years. It indicates that the soybean city nematode may also significantly cause the yield loss to the resistant varieties. And if these differences between the infested site and the non-infested site of a resistant soybean, the yield loss to the soybean city nematode probably is far underestimating. But we still need more research to confirm whether this is true real effect of the limited infestation or not. Now, why is the soybean certain limited is a big problem in the Minnesota? First, this limited is very pathogenic to the soybean. But in Minnesota, we still have some special conditions that favor the soybean certain limited. This limited have a very variability of genetic composition. So that a lot of genes in the limited, and they can overcome the resistance of the soybean, so they can adapt in different environments. Also, the limited, this limited can adapt a very cool environment. The key in Minnesota is that the corn soybean production is very conducive to the limited. The limited like this reproduction because the soybean cycle is very short and the limited can reproduce to very high density if you plant a successful soybean. The cool and wet soil favors other root diseases that may be induced by the soybean certain limited because the soybean certain limited can damage the roots and cause some other root diseases. That also is unique in Minnesota. And another thing I should mention is the high pH. There are a lot of high pH figure soil in Minnesota. This limited figure reproduce higher number in the high pH soil than in lower pH soil. And also the limited damage roots and induce the iron deficiency chlorosis, so that will increase the damage to the soybean. Now, what's the solution? Certainly, there are a lot of methods we can use to control soybean certain limited, but some methods we cannot use it in Minnesota. For example, if we can use the crop rotation, there is no problem there. But we have to plant the soybean at that bigger acreage. So now the most effective available method is that to use the resistant varieties, we need to tell the farmer, this is the only, well, the most effective the method to control the nematode. So far, there is no other very effective choice to manage the soybean certain limited. Then now, what do we need to do? We need to do some more research, and also there are some other issues we need to deal with, such as the agricultural policy or the marketing situation. Now the trend of the problem, this is also depends on what action we will take. If we take some action to control the limited, that maybe the problem will reduce. If we do not take some action, certainly the problem will become more serious. But I'm sure these two trends will happen. The limited will continue to spread, either across the fields or will spread to other counties, towards the northern counties. That will happen in future. Another is the race frequency will be changed. Now, most of the races are race 3, and most of these resistant varieties are resistant to race 3. But after several years, I do not know how many years, maybe 20 years, that all the races will be changed. That happened in southern states, such as Arkansas. And now Arkansas, all the kind of races are there. Then we can very difficult to use the resistant varieties. We do not know which resistant variety should have used. The problem is that it's very difficult to test the races. It's very time-consuming, very costly. Now, based on this situation, I just wanted to tell this research needs such an approach, because only to use the resistant variety cannot solve this problem. We need to find some other alternatives. And we need to continue to breed high yielding resistant cultivar, although some cultivars now are very high yielding. But still, we still have great potential to increase the yield potential of the resistant cultivars. And also we need to develop cultivars for northern counties. We only have one or two cultivars that can be used in the Red River Valley. The nematode will be there, and we need to prepare for that situation. And I think we need to include more resistant sources in breeding, because if the risk changed, we need to more resistant sources to fight in different races. And also we need to develop a system to monitor soybean certain nematode races, something missed. Now we cannot to test the soybean races because it is too expensive. And we need to develop alternative management such as, can we have third crops? This maybe depends on a lot of factors such as economic factors and market factors. But if you based on the soybean certain nematode management point of view, we really need a third crop. It will be better if we have a fourth crop. And we need to maybe identify any cover crops that may be used to in managing soybean certain nematode. If we wanted to see if there are any cover crops now in Minnesota, we tested a lot of cover crops. If there are any these crops that can reduce the nematode population density. And we can to see how can we adapt some cultural practices that may enhance natural antennas. There are a lot of fungal parasites or other parasites in the field. If for whatever reason, some fields, the nematode population that maintained much, much lower than others, how can we use this antagonism to reduce the nematode population? And we are trying to develop some biological control agents that can be used in management of the soybean nematode. But during all this, we still need some fundamental research on the biology and the ecology of the soybean certain nematode. Well, I just wanted to stop here. Maybe if you have any question, you can ask later.
Thank you, Dr. Chen. We also have on our agenda Pierre Friso from the Department of Agriculture. Did you have probably on similar, sort of the same topic. Do you have some comments you'd like to make?
Yeah.
I think we're on the...
Thank you, President Swinson. And I have some very brief questions, and I want to thank the committee for inviting me here as well. And once I saw Dr. Chen on the agenda, I didn't think there was too much more I could add to his very good comments, but I did... thought it might be helpful if I provide just a few comments about nematodes in general, and then also a few comments about how it relates to kind of the regulatory world and the market aspects, especially international agreements. Nematodes is actually a pretty large section of animals, and they're mainly microscopic, and most people can't see, and you sometimes see the cysts on the soybean roots. It's estimated in an acre of land you can have as many as 3 billion nematodes, so they're quite numerous. And if you dig up a pound of soil, you can have as many as 20 species. Now, most nematodes are actually marine, and there's only very few that are actually plant pathogens, and it's estimated that maybe 10% are actually plant pathogens. And those plant parasites, they can attack any part of the plant, either the flower, leaves, or any kind of foliar part, or usually it's the roots that is a problem. When they attack the roots, and it's a problem for the regulatory world, because as things are shipped around or exported or marketed, when soil comes with those products, that's how nematodes are moved around the world. Nematodes, there are good nematodes as well as bad ones, as Dr. Chen mentioned, so I want to make sure that people don't think that all nematodes are a problem. Nematodes damage crops by a number of ways, either direct mechanical injury by destroying the plant cells, or they secrete or inject an enzyme that harms the plant, or they can introduce a virus vector. Now, nematodes themselves don't move very far. They only move a few inches in the soil. So the real problem is when you move soil, and that can be moved either on farm equipment or movement of nursery stock or planting material, or even irrigation water is the way that nematodes move around. In fact, it's thought that soybean cyst nematode is first introduced into the United States from soil being brought from the Orient as a way of introducing the nitrogen-fixing bacteria that they weren't aware of, that they're also nematodes. And really, nematodes is people didn't really recognize the problem that they are. So because of that, the whole system of regulatory responses have been put into place to try and protect states and the country from nematodes and other plant pests. In fact, last year, this committee and the legislature passed a new Plant Protection Act that was sponsored by Representative Demmer, and it gave us a number of very important and powerful tools to help protect the state of Minnesota from a number of plant pests, including nematodes. The department works very closely with USDA APHIS in not only trying to protect the state or the country from the introduction of new nematodes or new plant pests, but we also work to ensure that the commodities, the agricultural products that we produce, that we can certify them as being free of those plant pests, or free of nematodes. And that's really the big problem with soybean cyst nematodes. It is really one of the few regulated nematodes that we have in Minnesota that creates a problem for us. Every year we survey and work with the university and look for nematodes. We look for Columbia rip knot nematode, golden nematode, potato rot nematode, a whole bunch of them. In fact, a few years ago, Mexico banned the importation of potatoes from 13 states, including Wisconsin and North Dakota. So they're both sides of Minnesota. They claimed they had found Columbia rip knot nematode. Fortunately, in Minnesota, we were able to prove that we did not have Columbia rip knot nematodes, that ensured that the movement of our crops can continue into Mexico. And that's one aspect I think a lot of people don't realize when we talk about the impact of soybean cyst nematode or any of these nematodes. There's a very direct cost to loss reduction or the yield reduction, but there's also a secondary cost, and that's the market that you lose. And in the case of soybean cyst nematode, it's not just soybeans, it's a lot of other crops. Nursery industry in particular is hit very hard by soybean cyst nematode, not because soybean cyst is a problem for nursery crops, it's a problem because they can't ship into Canada or other countries without going through a whole lot of regulatory hoops to meet those marketing needs. And it's the same as soybean seed. It comes from a soybean cyst quarantined county, and basically, as Dr. Chen showed you, the lower third, lower half of the state of Minnesota is infested. So, anything with soil on it, nursery stock, soybean seed can potentially have some soil particle. Potatoes is a big one that has soil on. They face a lot of extra regulatory problems in trying to market their crops because of these regulated nematodes. There, last year, we surveyed a number of counties, and we were able to look for 12 regulated nematodes in the state, in the Red River Valley. And one of the positive spin-off was that we didn't find any of those nematodes that we were searching for. By having those kinds of negative surveys, that ensures that we keep our markets open to not only other countries, but to other states. So that was just the aspect that I wanted to bring up about the nematodes and how they impact agriculture. I did want to also briefly mention, because I've been very involved with it over the past year or so, and that's the big pest on the horizon, I think most soybean growers are aware of it, is soybean rust. And there was a conference just yesterday. I was planning on attending. I had a family emergency and wasn't able to attend. But that is a disease. It's been documented to create anywhere from a 50% to 60% yield loss in areas where it's severe. The problem we have here in Minnesota is we don't have not developed the resistant varieties, and also we don't have currently fungicides that are labeled to protect our crop from those that disease. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture worked very hard this past summer together with Dr. Marty Draper at South Dakota University to get what's called a Section 18 exemption from EPA to allow the use of 4 fungicides to use for soybean rust in anticipation of soybean rust showing up in this in North America. Right now it's stuck just south of the equator, and there's a kind of a natural barrier that's created down there. Since it's windborne, the expectation is one of these days it's going to show up, and they believe once it shows up in Alabama or whatever that it's going to come like gangbusters across the soybean growing areas. It's important to have that Section 18 in place and established for soybean growers to use. That Section 18, I think, was submitted in late November to EPA. EPA typically has, I think, 90 days to review those applications. Our expectation is that applications will be approved and that those products will become available to soybean growers.
Thank you, Mr.
Friesel.
Next, we're on our agenda. We have Dr. Ken Ostley and Bruce Potter from the University of Minnesota. I'm not sure how they're going to make the presentation, but they're going to talk to us about aphids and the situation. You know, that was a big problem this past year in Minnesota in the soybean crop.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to hear.
I guess up first is Mr. Bruce Potter, who is also with the University of Minnesota.
Sorry about that, but I guess what I'm going to try to do, and I'm going to let Dr. Ostley cover the bulk of the soybean aphid information. Again, thank you for having the opportunity to present here. But I'm going to try to transition a little bit between some of the plant disease stuff and into soybean aphid. And if we look at soybean aphids, I mean, basically what we're trying to do is grow soybeans in this part of the world, and aphids are kind of confusing the issue for us a little bit. If we look at what kind of yield losses we can have in plots, we can have up to 50% yield loss. Now, soybean aphids are also capable of transmitting some viruses, and we're assuming that we don't have many of the viruses in the system, such as soybean mosaic virus, for these insects to transmit. So this is the insect itself. Typically it's less than that, 20-30% yield loss. The other thing to look at on these soybean aphids, they're not like your typical insect problem, not like corn borers, corn rootworms. They really are best viewed as obligate parasites. They're very good at it, probably better than even the nematodes Sen Yu Chen you mentioned, because if they go, the plants go under stress, the aphids get crowded, they're capable of leaving, okay? The other thing to look at is they really are a little bit more similar to a disease outbreak than most insects we're used to dealing with. In other words, if you watch the progression of these things over the summer, they moved out of the areas where they were coming off of buckthorn and had the initial populations high early, and you could see that band of aphids just progressing westward across the state. Okay? And we just heard a little bit about soybean rust. Kind of a similar scenario. Okay? The thing I want to point out about soybean aphids is this is kind of a wake-up call for Minnesota agriculture. Okay? We've got a new problem. Definitely there's some economic impacts. Ken's going to talk about those a little bit. There's other problems that we don't have yet. Okay? Soybean rust being an example. And in fact, people are quite panicked about that disease, even though we don't have it yet. Okay. Now, how many of you think that everything worked perfectly with soybean aphids this summer? Okay. Some things worked fairly well, some things didn't. So we've got some strengths and weaknesses in our infrastructure, and really we need to be paying attention and improving the system. Okay, I'm not going to go through a lot of these, but we did have a lot of experiments out for soybean aphids this summer. We had some things specially geared towards soybean aphids, the relationship of aphid populations to yield loss. Looked at some foliar and seed applied control methods, in other words, how to control this pest once we have it. But the thing I want to point out, and I think this is something that we need to keep in mind, or I hope you keep in mind about the university and the research and outreach centers, is a lot of the stuff that we did this summer was an adaptation of work we already had going on. Okay? And we were able to adapt that to look at a new pest. And things like data planning, what are the differences there, row spacing, population. The beauty of having an institution like the university, I believe, is the ability to adapt new problems like this because of the infrastructure we have. The other thing that's important to remember is that we do have a little bit of a different environment here than we do in northwest Minnesota, southeast Minnesota, and it's important to look at these things over a lot of environmental conditions. I do want to thank you, the people that have supported soybean research in the past, okay, and I hope that continues. I'm not going to show you a lot of data. I'm going to leave that to Ken. And all this is, in a nutshell, is a summary of looking at several trials in Minnesota. And what this line is representing, it represents is the relationship of aphid populations to yield loss. In other words, the more aphids you have for the longer period of time, the greater your yield losses. And this is a pretty good fit for biological data. Remains to be seen how well this holds through for particular years, but at least it gives us a way to evaluate economic thresholds. And just to prove that we're not alone out here, we do have some predators. The good thing is there's some of these organisms that have already been here feeding on other aphid species that are managing to adapt. This is a native lady beetle, Cobvamilla maculata. And this is an example of, in one field at Lamberton now, but here we have the C. maculata populations through time. The green bar here is soybean aphids. You can see that there's a lot of aphids foraging early. This dotted red line here, if you can make it out, is Asian lady beetle introduced, and it comes from about the same area as soybean aphid. You see where these aphid populations are taking off? There's a gap in lady beetle protection. Okay? Once these things start getting out of hand, we have these Asian lady beetles trying to keep up. In this case, it didn't work. All they're managing to do is increase their population for your house this winter. But we are.
Swenson, committee members, soybean growers, and guests. Thanks a lot for offering this opportunity. In a sense, I have a confession to make. I'd rather not be here. If we go back 5 years ago, I wouldn't have been here. In just that short amount of time, we have discovered a new pest in Minnesota and seen what it's capable of doing. And Minnesota's been uniquely poised to address this issue because at the university, we've had a number of people with soybean insect experience that were able to recognize the problem coming and start working on it as it got here. We have these soybean growers willing to jump into the fray with funding. We have the wisdom of the legislature in setting up the Rapid Ag Response Funds so that within the university, they can redirect money to this problem. I'll give you an example of why that fund is so critical. My ongoing operating budget at the unit is $12,000. So the extra funding to address any issues has to come from outside sources, grants, legislative support. Well, let's get going on what the challenges are that the soybean acre poses to us. As Bruce mentioned, it's unlike any other pests that we normally encounter in corn and soybeans. That's because we're dealing with clone warfare. In the summer, populations of aphids are essentially female. They give birth to live young. Those young grow up in 5 days, start producing their own young. And this thing cascades like you wish your retirement company. So you have populations doubling every 2 to 3 days. Now, what's interesting about that is that you can have one aphid per plant, and in less than 3 weeks that translates to thousands per plant with this kind of doubling. And as Bruce mentioned, in response to crowding, poor nutrition, or seasonal cues, the females literally switch over to producing young that will develop wings, fly away to infest other plants, other fields, and even engage in long-distance dispersal. And that's, on the average, they're moving about 7 to 10 miles per day. And so that's pretty phenomenal over the course of the summer, considering these aphids are less than a 16th of an inch long. They suck sap. So they're robbing the plant of energy that would be going into future growth and yield potential. But not only that, they mess up photosynthesis so that even though those plants look perfectly green and are sitting out there, they're not fixing energy like they should. And so the impact is way out of proportion with the number of insects. Okay. We know for the last couple of years that hard winters can knock them back. And between 2002 and 2003, their range was severely restricted. And you saw this thing collapse back down to lower infestation levels. Unfortunately, the ladybugs that Bruce was mentioning took a hit as well, and probably a more severe hit than the aphids. Okay? So they come out of this overwintering host called buckthorn, they move into soybeans early in the spring, and then there are two main periods of dispersal through the course of the summer where an abundance of winged aphids are produced. Next slide. And this shows you that seasonal dispersal courtesy of the Minnesota Department of Ag survey program, which has been extremely critical in keeping on top of this whole situation. And you can see how it blossomed out of southeast Minnesota and literally spread across the entire state, reclaiming everything in its range that it lost the previous winter. So as we start to look at the seasonal implications for Minnesota, I suspect that we'll see it successfully overwinter with a higher frequency in the southeast, and that this seasonal spread across the state of Minnesota will become a typical feature. And so out here, we may not have early colonization except in areas with lots of buckthorn or protected areas. But the majority of the acreage are going to get infested in the middle of the summer if the buildup in the southeast is stronger. Next. Fortunately, we've discovered at the U that temperature plays a big role in population dynamics. If you take a look at this graph, over here is survival of females and how long they survive at different temperatures. And here is the number of young they produce. And you can see when temps are in the 68, 77 degree range, we get the maximum number of young produced. And at these cooler temperatures, we're also getting the maximum survivors. And if you think about last summer, cool temps were pretty much the norm through much of the summer. Favorable conditions for aphids to just explore. Next slide. What's this going to mean in the long run? I think every year is going to play out slightly differently in terms of infestation dynamics, and that's not what we want to hear. But the reality is that soybean aphids here to stay. And let's see what else we can do to manage this insect. Right now, our threshold is about 250 aphids per plant, and I like to tease the farmers that this number came out of a session in 2001 after we first recognized aphids were causing the problem. At a meeting of entomologists over beers, we decided this is the threshold. Okay. Now, that may not inspire much confidence, right? But the unfortunate thing is that the scouting window goes all the way from two leaves out there all the way to Podfill. And the dilemma is, how many times can you visit the field in this stretch of time? Next. We have found out based on-farm trials that have been reported by soybean growers like you that the average yield response has been about 9 bushels per acre. And you can see the range here is almost nothing, up to 27. And so you get values approaching that 50% yield loss in some cases. Primary effect on pod number when you have early infestations with a shift towards seed size and later infestations. And there's a slight impact on quality of the foil protein shift underway. Next. In terms of yield response, you see there's a whole cloud of points here. And that's because when an individual farmer puts out a trial like this and reports his results to us, they vary in terms of when this aphids got there, how severe they were, what stage the soybean was in, was the grower on top of the situation, or were they a little bit behind, products different in their effectiveness. But the interesting thing is, here's that average of 9 bushels per acre, but we also see a date effect where the potential return diminishes, so that by the time we get into mid-August, we're reaching a point where it's not worth spraying. Here's a visual example of soybean insecticide spray effects and times. This was sprayed in late July by an aerial applicator near Bloor. He went on to work on the other growers' fields in that area, and finally, as the spraying started to subside, he looked at the rest of this field he deliberately left, and when he realized that there was so much honeydew, which is a sticky, syrupy sap excreted by the aphids, and when he walked through the field, there was so much honeydew that he said he could almost stand his pants up in the corner after the sap had dried. And he decided he'd better spray again, so he sprayed another strip. About a week later, he sprayed a third, and then we have an untreated strip down here. And you can see timing makes a big difference. Here's 55 bushels versus 36, and just waiting 8 days resulted in a 13 bushel less return. And it's because these pests are duplicate, doubling every 3 days or 2 days. So, how many growers here have experienced some application delays? Or did you get it all applied when you wanted it? Okay. You're a shy bunch. But we have areas of the state with 5-day delays. And in 5 days, you can see a fourfold increase in the population. So even if you were observing our recommendations, going out there and saying, I've got 250 aphids I better treat, by the time they got there, you had over 1,000 aphids. Mm-hmm. And huge pest problems like this really tax our application industry. It was amazing to get that much work done in 3 days, and I think we can thank the Department of Ag for expediting the process for getting these guys, what's the correct term, licensed in Minnesota. I think they did a nice job of it. Okay, next slide. The problem is we've got this increasing population, and if we're operating at about 250 is when we ought to treat, okay, we have to build into our decision any delays. And so our thresholds are probably going to end up being reduced. Bruce showed you this yield response data. We can use that to look at thresholds. And when we do the calculations, we discover that a fairly good number. Next. Here's the products that are registered. Growers need to be aware of restricted entry intervals. They also need to be aware of pre-harvest intervals as they deal with these products. And we're concerned about resistance in the long run because aphids in general are notorious for developing resistance. So if we get in a pattern of heavy infestations and repeated insecticide use, we'll have to start looking out for resistance. Fortunately, we've been able to discover that ground and air applications are relatively comparable in their effectiveness, which has really diversified our options. And many of the products are extremely good at killing soybean aphid. The only problem is that every aphid you leave behind is female and reproductive. And so not only have the survivors reproducing, but because of these colonization periods, you can get more aphids coming into fields. And occasionally we see the need to treat fields twice. Right now, these are our recommendations. Probably the thing that's changed the most is that in the last few years, we realized that almost anywhere in Minnesota is potentially favorable to an outbreak. We've got this broad scouting window, you know, that we really focus on from beginning bloom all the way through into early beginning seed fill. Threshold's about 250 acres per plant. And as I mentioned before, we're extremely lucky in Minnesota to have had the people in place, the funding there. In fact, there are other states that are literally drooling over the information that you have access to here in Minnesota. In fact, by the end of January, entomologists from Minnesota will have given presentations on soybean aphid all the way from through South Dakota, Iowa, Missouri, Illinois, Wisconsin, to name a few of the states. Obviously, we had fun down here, but I want to highlight a couple of things right here. Our IPM specialists are really critical to this. These are people like Bruce Potter who are out here in the field working right in this situation all the time, and they know what's going on. They know what resources they've got at the station, and have done a very good job. As I mentioned, funding has come from the Minnesota Rapid Ag Response Fund, the Soybean Promotion Council, and even the North Central Soybean District Program. Probably the piece that's missing at the moment is some dedicated support. Because we're trying to piece this together year after year after year, worried that we may not get the funding to hold on to the people that we've got that have experienced. And with that, I'm done. Hope that whirlwind overview gives you an idea of what we're facing with this pest. I think in the future we're going to see dramatic improvements in a number of other areas of research, including soybean breeding with respect to this pest. Bruce mentioned biological control is another area we're going to see. We may see some improvements in as well. And just a lot better characterization of the problem.
Thank you, Dr. Osley. I guess for those of us that thought maybe the aphid problem was a thing that we had this last year, and we probably wouldn't need to be worrying about every year. From his presentation, it sounds like it's probably going to be an issue we have to deal with over time. And I guess, and hopefully there can ways can be found to control it. I know I've had farmers in my community telling me that next year I'm going to plant very few, if any, soybeans. I'm going to plant my whole farm in corn, and of course, I guess that's their option. But I think we want to, you know, soybeans are being a big crop, and with the biodiesel developments and so forth, we want soybeans to continue to be a profitable and viable crop for Minnesota. So it's something that's going to have to continue to be looked at and worked with. So. Our next speaker is Dr. Bill Lazarus from the University of Minnesota. To talk about, well, he's listed as soybean profitability. Well,
thank you, Chairman. Chairman Swenson, thank you for the invitation to be here today. Different ways you could approach the profitability discussion, I guess. What I decided to try to do in just a few minutes here is just look at the farm record summaries, Southwest Farm Management Association and the Minsku Farm Business Program records. We have them in a database at the university that we can summarize in various ways pretty easily. It's a tremendous resource for lots of different management policy questions. So I hope it's useful to you on an individual farm basis, those of you that participate in that. Next slide, please. Unfortunately, in terms of looking at the profitability situation for 2003, we don't have the 2003 records summarized yet. Here, the first column in this slide is an average of the 3 years, 1999 to 2001, and then about 2002 records in the second column there. These numbers are pretty small. I'm not sure if you can see them in the back. I have 30 copies of these slides here that you can pick up afterwards if you're interested in the details. The last few years have been pretty good for soybean production. The average for 99 to 2001, we've got here at the top, the blue area is yields and harvest time prices. The enterprise record summaries that we do with the programs are generally done on something approximating a harvest time price. And then the black area is direct plus overhead cost per acre and per bushel. And down at the bottom of that net return, two things that I didn't have room to show on here, on the return side, government payments, and on the cost side is the opportunity cost of the unpaid operators' labor and management. So two things that are more or less offsetting that are not included here. The bottom blue section there, net return, includes those two items. You see for 1999 and 2001, soybeans looked pretty profitable relative to corn, $21 per acre compared to a negative $35 for corn. 2002 was a good year for both, $33 net return for soybeans, $21 for corn. So the difference narrowed quite a bit in 2002. So then what I decided to do is just do some projections based on the preliminary data on yield impacts as well as what's happened to prices this year. That's what's here. The state average yield that USDA was projecting in November was, I think, 31 bushels. The association and the Minsku farms tend to run in this part of the state run a little bit more than that. You just look at the change from 2002 to 2003 and assume the same percentage change here, come out to 34 bushels for soybeans and 144 for corn. So down 14 bushels on each, but obviously percentage-wise, that's a much bigger drop for soybeans than it is for corn. Prices, obviously, though, have been going up quite a bit, particularly with soybeans. The most recent state average price that the NAS has for soybeans is $7.16 a bushel, and $2.27 for corn. And so I ran some numbers based on that. That's well and good. But one of my colleagues there in the department looked at this and said, well, I priced a lot of my beans early in the growing season, and he didn't tell me what he priced them at, but I don't think it was $7.15 a bushel. So you can think of lots of scenarios that would be more negative than this, but this is what you get with those prices. On the cost side, I factored in just inflation based on the index of prices paid that USDA has for last spring compared to a year earlier. I can't remember all the details, but I guess fertilizer jumped quite a bit this year, I think. I don't think the other price cost really changed as much, but that would increase the cost per acre $8 for soybeans and $12 for corn. I didn't try to estimate what the cost of the treatments for aphids would be in there. Ken and I were talking on the way down here. That probably bumps cost up a few bucks more than that, depending on whether the farm treated or not. But I don't have those figures in here. But at any rate, I was kind of surprised when I did this. Net return for soybeans still comes out 15 bucks an acre, and corn's a negative 5. So it didn't look as nearly as negative on soybeans as I expected, but obviously, assuming that $7.16 per bushel price. So anyway, that's what you get, and the 2003 records will be out probably another 2 to 3 months, and we'll see how close this is. But that's some idea. Looks like soybean net returns will be down about $18 an acre from 2002. Corn down about 30 bucks an acre. So it's not as good as a year ago, but still not a terrible situation. That's just a quick extrapolation from the 2002 records. Then the question is, how might next year look? Obviously, the national soybean supply and demand situation is quite tight. So the next slide, please. I just took a quick look at that. I think the other speakers might look in more detail at the outlook. But Bob Wisner down at Iowa State is one person I know that tracks the grain markets more closely than I do. I just pulled off a couple things from a balance sheet that he has on his webpage this is from about last October, so it's not quite up to date. But he was looking at the preliminary national figures of 34 bushels for soybeans, and has three scenarios there for next year. One would be basically the same yield as this year, another 34 bushel yield, which would be a pretty tight supply situation. And he also looked at 39.5 bushels per acre, which would be pretty much a normal crop that we've seen for the past few years before this year. And he also looked at a 41 bushel yield, which would be pretty close to a record. And then the bottom slide there is just weeks of end of season weeks of carryover supply and you can see the way that's been dropping the past few years, and the supply has been tightening up, and then what those three scenarios would do in terms of ending carryovers. Below yield would leave it about where it is now, about 2 weeks of supply, and normal crop bump it up to about 3, or if you had a record crop, maybe 6 weeks or so. And then the prices that he's projecting from that, another tight year could put up at a price, I think it's $8.05 there, or a normal year could bring it down to about $5.20. or maybe as much as 470 if you have a real bumper crop there. So just thinking about those kinds of scenarios, I have the next slide. I looked at just another year of projection from those vectors, and actually I borrowed this for the most part from Jim Christensen, who's the association fieldman up at Lamberton, and he has an optimistic and a pessimistic scenario on his webpage, and I didn't have time to talk about both, so I just took a midpoint of the two, and that would work out to about a 44 bushel per acre yield, and 145 bushels for corn, and then I looked at a $6 soybean price and $2.15 for corn. Actually, he used $5.65 for soybeans, which is 35 cents under the fall futures price for next fall. But the futures market has moved up some since he did that, and using the same basis would put you about $6. And so working that through, then net return over the cost and opportunity cost will put you about $15 per acre for soybeans, and about a plus $4 for corn. So that's, I guess, not as good as 2002, certainly, but isn't the end of the world, I think, as far as economics either. The next slide. Those were enterprise budgets. We also can look at total farm, whole farm numbers, and I just looked at crop farms in the southwestern part of the state. And this is net farm income. The top there is net farm income for crop farms going back to 1998. And it jumps around quite a bit. 2002 was quite a good year. 2000 was as well, and 2001 obviously was much less profitable. But just take everything the way it was in 2002, and then just and basically the average acreage was, I think, 680 bushels, 680 acres per farm. And if you just assume 50-50 corn and soybean acreage, and factor in that. That change of $18 less per acre on soybeans and $30 less for corn, that would bring you down from about a $50,000 net farm income down to about $35,000 or so that you might see this year. And again, that's based on that $7.16 price on the soybeans and 34 bushel yield, and obviously we're going to see a lot of farm-to-farm variability and yields, and as well as marketing strategies that are going to cause the usual farm-to-farm variability that we always see in these records. You can see that the debt-to-asset ratio has been dropping nicely in recent years, and so I don't know where that's going to go next year. Just one more slide here, and then I'll close. Just wanted to make the point that's been made lots of times before, you can see that the debt-to-asset ratio has been dropping nicely in recent years, and so I don't know where that's going to go next year. Just one more slide here, and then I'll close. Just wanted to make the point that's been made lots of times before, but sometimes gets lost in the discussion as what the implications might be on the land market from introduction of a new pest or anything that hurts profitability like we're talking about here. I just wanted to point out what a large part of the cost of producing soybeans and corn is land rent on average. About 40% of the direct and overhead cost that I was showing you there is land rent. So if things stay negative on the profitability side in the short run, I'd expect that the labor management return of the operators will be where the pinch is felt. But over the longer run, land market is probably going to be affected, and so that'll be something to watch. I don't know how much this is going to be affected by a given change in profitability, but it is a pretty large portion of the cost. So that's a quick few thoughts on the profitability situation, and I'll be happy to take questions later when we open things up. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Lazarus. We have one more presenter, Dr. John Bays of the United States, the United Soybean Board Consultant. Before he starts, I just want to say that the coffee and cookies, which are over here, and you're all welcome to take part in, are given to us by the Soybean Growers Association, so we want to say thank you to them for that. And also, I saw former Representative Dr. Mulder in the audience. Just want to say welcome. Nice to see you. He was from this part of the state. So. And with that, I'll say welcome to John Bays of the United Soybean Board. So.
Thank you very much. Opportunity. I enjoy being back in Minnesota. I always joke that it was for several years after I came to Minnesota that I didn't know that it was always quiet out here, because all the farmers always had beer in the wintertime. But fortunately, I've been able to come back in the summertime where it was a lot nicer. Like your first slide, I'm going to be talking about just a quick overview of the global marketplace that I think is helpful to understand what may be. You've got the pests and diseases that are burned into industry, but you also need to understand the other challenges that are facing the industry. This first one, as I like to show, is percentage change in global demand for soybeans, corn, wheat, cotton, and rice since 1990. What it shows is that since 1990, we've seen a 96% growth in global demand for soybeans. It's only about 30% for corn, and for wheat, it's only down 5 or 6% in global growth and demand. That's a function of really growing global incomes and demand for meat and poultry. Next one. Global soybean meal consumption, as you see, is up this year to about 140 million tons, almost double, of course, what it was in 1990. Next one. The key here is that we're seeing global consumption of pork, poultry meat, and beef. And it's the growth in the world is really occurring in poultry meat and pork. And of course, those are the two species that require higher concentrates of protein in their diet. And that's why we're moving to see such growth in soybean demand. Next one. The other competitor, the biggest competitor that soybean oil faces in the world is palm oil, which is produced primarily in Southeast Asia. It's the lowest cost production oil in the world. It's a tough competitor because when you plant a palm tree, it's going to be there for the next 30 years or until it gets too tall to get the palm fronds off or the palm fruit off. So as long as the price of oil is greater than the cost to get the fruit off the tree, they're going to pick it every year. So it's the one we challenge us the most. But soybean oil is continuing to expand. One of the things that's particularly important for Minnesota is this shows the global exports of soybeans versus exports of soybean meal and soybean oil. We're seeing now that we're seeing a faster growth in demand overseas for soybeans than we are for meal and oil. That's primarily driven by China, but we're building a lot of new crushing plants in the Middle East. A new one opened this year in Dubai. We've had new ones in Turkey, Jordan, Syria, and they're wanting beans. That puts a lot of pressure on the domestic crushers because they're facing more competition for the beans we do produce, and there's less markets in the world for the meal and oil that we export. Next one. Other issue here is the competitors to soy. There's rapeseed and sunseed. Unlike soy, which is the demand for soy is driven by the demand for soybean meal. The soybean oil largely is produced as a byproduct. But in the case of rapeseed and sunseed, they're both 42-43% oil. They're driven by the demand for oil. So if you see low vegetable oil prices, you're going to see less production of rapeseed and sunseed. And that's what's happened. We had high oil prices back here in 98, and then prices fell down to where there was only 10 or 11 cents a pound. But now we've got oil back up to 28, 29 cents a pound, and we're going to see a big surge in the production of rapeseed and sunseed globally because it's more competitive to grow those crops. Next one. But even with the growth in palm oil and rapeseed and sunseed, global stocks for ending stocks of veg oil are going down to where we're going to see a 23-year low this year in veg oil stocks. It's because we're just not getting enough rapeseed, sunseed, soybean, palm oil produced to meet the demand from a rising population with higher incomes that wants more veg oil in their diet. Next one. The big thing that you have to talk about in the case of soybeans is China. This graph shows what's happened to soybean meal consumption in China since 1990. You can see it's grown by 2,100% in 13 years. That's a phenomenal area. Next one. And the thing that's driving it, this is production of pork, poultry meat, and aquaculture. As you can see, China is by far the biggest pork producer in the world. In fact, they produce seven times as many hogs as we do in the United States, and we're number two. They produce five times as much pork. The other one that's really growing fast is aquaculture. That's everything from shrimp and eels over to all kinds of carp and catfish and whatever. They are the largest aquaculture producer in the world. In fact, they're 25 times larger than the second largest producer, which is India. The bottom one is poultry meat. It doesn't look like that's grown that much compared to the other ones, but it's grown by 250%, and they are now only second to the United States in broiler meat production in China. This year, they're going to use 5 million tons of soybean meal in China just to feed fish. And one of the things that I contribute to the checkoff is that most of that technology to produce those fish using soybean meal over there has been paid for by U.S. farmers through the checkoff to teach them how to produce those fish. The fish formula, the feed formulas for fish in China that are set out by the government, the formulas are written by the staff of the American Soybean Association in China. Next one. This is Chinese soybean imports. Go back to 1995. That wasn't very long ago. Only 800,000 tons. In fact, you'll find that if you went the year before that, they exported more soybeans than they imported. This year, they're going to import 22 million tons. So far, they've already bought 7.6 million tons of U.S. soybeans this year, and they're probably going to buy some more. So it's a huge impact on the global market. Next one. Look at the domestic market a bit on soybean oil. The yellow here is soybean oil. The other oils here are rapeseed oil, corn oil, cottonseed oil, palm oil, and sunseed. Those are the oils consumed in the U.S. And it shows that about 76% of the oil consumed in the U.S. is soybean oil. And we've got a challenge there because of the trans fatty acid rules that are out now. But the industry is working very hard to develop new soybeans that will not require to be hydrogenated, so we can get away from that issue and we can continue the industry. Next one. This is one that's challenging for Minnesota, too, as you've got two new crush plants open. Because of the tight crop we have this year, strong global demand, particularly from China, we're not going to have the soybeans available to crush in the U.S. that we normally have. In fact, USDA says we're going to crush 215 million bushels less soybeans in this marketing year than we did 2 years ago. That means some crushing plants are going to get shut down. And we've added two new ones in Minnesota that have, in fact, added new capacity. So we're seeing plants already begin shut down in Alabama. We're going to see some more plants shut down. It's a tough year for industry to be opening crushing plants, to be blunt about it. But it's just the main thing is you can't crush what you don't have. And the Chinese and others are willing to pay more for the soybeans than our crushers were here. Next one. This is U.S. monthly crushing margins, average crushing margins since 1994 through 2003 and through August. As you can see, we had some really spikes in good years. We had a really bad period here. By the way, we built a lot of new crushing plants, and we had those margins for a while. And now we've got low margins that are going to stay low for the next year, in my opinion, because we just don't have the demand and the supply. Yes. This is U.S. soybean meal consumption. We grew real fast, but now it's flattening off and going down. And one of the reasons it's going down is because we're not producing any because we don't have enough supply this year. But also, our livestock industry is not growing as fast. Next one. We've got pork consumption. Pork production in the U.S. has grown very fast, but now it's stabilized. maybe is in fact, we'll see what is going to happen in the future. Next one is poultry meat, or broiler meat, continues to grow. It's the cheapest meat to produce. It's continuing to grow relatively fast. The U.S. has done very well in poultry meat, and of course it's the one that consumes more soy meal than any other species. Next one, turkey meat, which is of course important for Minnesota. Variable from year to year, the trend is still up, and again, but not much growth anymore. Next one. One of the things that drove the industry in the last few years was the growth in exports of pork and poultry meat. As you can see, we really had a surge here in the 90s with exporting pork and poultry meat. But the bloom is off that rose, and we're flat now, and I suspect it's going to decline in the future. And if we, particularly if we don't get the livestock industry in the U.S. expanded, there's too many burdens on the industry in the U.S. today to compete on a global basis. Next one. One of the things that soybeans that we have to accept is that we're putting a whole lot of ethanol plants out there today. I know that the reasons why it's being done, it makes sense for farmers, but the byproduct of it is distillers dry grains, and it has to find a home somewhere. And based on the latest projections, we're going to see a displacement of about 4.2 million tons of soybean meal in the next few years by the distillers dry grains that are coming out of ethanol plants. So it's going to back up on our other crop because we've seen the byproduct out of DDG, DDG from ethanol. Next one is the soybean oil consumption in the U.S. grown, but it's down this year. Again, one of the reasons it's down, we're not crushing the beans, we don't have the oil. Next one. And the other one is because, again, because of all the corn processing that we're doing, we're putting out a lot of corn oil out of our plants, and it's finding a home in the marketplace. And doing so, it's displacing relatively new growth and demand for soybean oil. The next one, Canada. Canada's been a really good market in the U.S. People don't recognize this, but our value of our soybean exports to Canada are substantially better than higher than the value of the wheat export from Canada to the U.S. We tend to forget that when we're talking about the problems with wheat from Canada. But the reality is it's been a growth market. Big market for meal. The reason is, next slide, is that Canadians' exports of pork have really been growing because they've got an industry up there that's growing fast. The government is very supportive of it. And this year, Canada is the largest exporter of pork in the world. We didn't tend to forget that. But that's a good market for U.S. soybean meal going north. And no one benefits more from that than you in the, here in Minnesota and in the Dakotas, because the meal that's coming out of the plants, these new plants, plus the plant in Vaughan, South Dakota, Dawson, Enderlin, North Dakota, a lot of that meal moves north into to supply the hog industry in Manitoba. Next one. I want to talk, just to show you briefly, this is Mexico, soybean meal and oil consumption. We've heard a lot of negatives that NAFTA didn't do any good. It sure did for the soybean industry, because this is the growth in demand for soybean meal in Mexico, and NAFTA started about right here. So there's a lot of that growth is attributable to economic growth that occurred in Mexico because of NAFTA. And we've seen a lot of growth in demand there for oil as well. Next one. Just a few things to show you what the future might be for soybeans and why it's an important crop. This is the capita consumption of soybean meal, as you see over here in the European Union, in the United States, really high levels, 90 kilograms here. If you get over here in these parts of the world, Indonesia, 8.9 kilograms, India, 1.5. Every one kilogram increase in demand for soybean meal in India is 1 million tons of meal, which is 1.3 million tons of beans. So it's, in fact, a really important market, and we're beginning to see relatively rapid growth in demand for meal in India. Next one. Luke, I did some slides on what's happened in acreage and crops in Minnesota. Particularly here, go back to since 1990, this was corn acreage, is relatively stable. It's bean acres that have really picked up to where this year you planted more acres of beans than you had planted of corn. And it makes a lot of sense. You move toward an equalized rotation. One of the reasons that occurred is because we passed back here in 95 the Freedom to Farm legislation, that gave farmers planting flexibility, and they really took advantage of it by evening out their planting rotation. Next one. This is production of corn and soybeans in Minnesota during those years. Next one is the yields of corn and soybeans in Minnesota. I think I'll probably remember that year, 93. The next slide shows what I did was take the average corn yield in the state divided by the average soybean yield and say, what's happening? Is that going to change the corn outdoing beans? As you can see, really hadn't changed much. This year here is totally out of line with the rest of it. And the reason we had just a unique year of very dry weather, late off July and August, that really nailed the bean crop and allowed the acres to become maximum impact, but you'd already had enough moisture early in the year to produce a good corn crop. So this year is very atypical in terms of having low soybean yields relative to good corn yields. In fact, if you look back, you've had just as many times when those corn yields didn't hold their own in the past. But we've had a really sort of a unique period here of very stable bean to corn yields, except for this year. Next one. This shows that same thing for the entire U.S. average yields. It looks like there may be a little growth in relative corn yields on average to bean yields. But again, we had that very abnormal one year. This year says that this was not indicative of what the future is going to be, in my opinion. Next one. This is just an idea on swine harvested. They are marketed in the state of Minnesota. It's important for you as the soybean producers here, particularly now that you've got the new plants to supply meal. Continue to see growth in the number of hogs marketed in the state. Next one. Number of turkeys produced in the state. I've got that as a scale of 37 to 47, but again, it's still on the upward trend. Next one is the value of the major crops in 2002. You can see the importance here of corn and soybeans in the state of Minnesota. And if you look at what's next, over here you got hogs, cattle, dairy, turkeys over here. Those are the biggest crops produced in the state, the biggest ones by far. Our corn and soybeans. Next one. Now we're going to do a quick look at the bad part, which is Brazil and Argentina. You can see this is production of soybeans in the United States in the blue, the South America in the red. We were always the biggest, but they blew by us very quickly and are continuing to expand. A lot of that's due to not only strong global demand, but the devaluation of their currencies, which greatly increased the profitability of soybean production in South America. Next one. Is percentage change in harvested area in 1990. We actually expanded our acreage faster than did South America for a while, but we ran out of acres. They got a lot of acres to go, and they're now have expanded their percentages of their acreage more than we have. Next one. One of the troubling things is this is average yield trend lines in the United States, Argentina, and Brazil for soybeans. This is Brazil's trend line. It's very steep growth, upward growth in yields. This is Argentina, which is growing faster than our average yields. And our yields are not keeping up in beans with South Americans. I'm not sure all of the reasons there. Certainly one of the things, they don't have all the pests that we've had in a lot of those areas because we've been growing soybeans for a long time. And they're moving into new areas. But this is something that's great concern to the soybean industry, I can assure you, is that our yields are not moving faster than they are. Next one. This is soybean exports out of the United States. We can always count on being the biggest exporter of whole soybeans, but not this year. Because of our less crop, Brazil's going to export more whole soybeans this year than will the United States. At the rate they're going, Argentina probably will certainly get up closer to that. But the key is that Argentina and Brazil have been huge exporters of soybean meal and oil because of the policies that they had favored exports of meal and oil. And they have really dominated those industries. Next one is, but ending stocks. I said, you see all this growth. I wanted, before I show you the future and the negatives, to say that we're still seeing the lowest ending stocks of soybeans this year projected than we've had since 1976. So the bottom line to that is that the world has needed every soybean we, South America, grew because we're using up everything we grew. And that's important to remember. Next one. Here's the problem that you face in Brazil. This shows the overgrowing areas of soybeans in Brazil, which are in Paraná, Rio Grande do Sul, and Santa Catarina, in Buenos Aires province in the south. That's where they got up, mainly growing about 14 and a half million tons of beans. That's where they started. But they've moved into the new areas in the Cerrados region. Here is a savanna shrubland, and that's where you see, that's the states of Mato Grosso, Goiás, Tocantins, out of this area. Some estimates, they believe that they had, versus 1990, 180 million acres left to break in and bring into production. That was in pasture that could be brought into farm that you expect to be brought into production. The next one, if you want to see how big that is, this is the Midwest from Ohio, Minnesota, to Kansas, stuff over the new growing areas. It's big. It's real big. And they've got the potential to really grow a lot of soybeans in that area. But they're also getting very interested in growing a lot of corn and a lot of everything else. Next one. The problem is because we've got high fixed costs in the U.S., our land prices are high. We've got a lower variable cost, at least back in when USDA did this survey, than South America. Our variable cost production were less. But our fixed costs are so high that we have a higher total cost production substantially than do the South Americans. That was even worse today because since they devalued their currencies, their labor has gone down, their land prices relatively have gone down, a lot of things. So they're in a very good catbird seat position to compete with us. Next one is another thing that you ought to be very interested in and pay a lot of attention to, and this is exports of pork and poultry meat out of Brazil. This year, already, Brazil is going to be the world's largest exporter of beef. Of course, for certain, now that we've got mad cow. But more than that, they will become the largest exporter of pork and poultry meat within the next 3 to 4 years. That is no question about it in my mind. Cheapest place in the world to grow poultry meat and pork today is Brazil. Next one. This is Brazilian production of corn, continuing to expand. There's a lot of priority now is putting getting new varietals there that they've got some of those varieties out in the Cerrados region that are yielding 140 to 150 bushel corn. Once they get that all sorted out, they're going to be a huge producer of corn, and their goal is to feed it to livestock for export. Next one. This is Brazilian yields of corn. It's still only average around 50 bushels, but look at the trend line. It's beginning to move. And the corn yields would be much higher than this, but they mainly plant their corn in the dry season after they've harvested soybeans. So they're harvesting two crops a year. And if they planted corn more in the wet season, they could get a lot better yields. Next one. You're going to need a lot of production. All I did here was to have the computer take the growth in demand for soybeans for the last 13 years and extend it out and say if we have continue that growth rate through 2013, it means we're going to need 70 million tons of soybeans additional above today's current production levels to meet global demand. Put that in perspective, this year's crop in the U.S. was 66 million tons. We're going to need another U.S. crop in 10 years in the world somewhere to supply global demand. Next one. This is what USDA says the future looks like for exports. I don't always accept it, but they say that all the growth in export demand, according to them, is going to come out of South America. I don't believe that necessarily because I think they're going to have a lot of problems in the future with a lot of the things that we're talking about. They already have Asian rust, which has given them a fit. They're going to get aphids somewhere down the road. Nematodes are going to become a lot bigger problem for them. They're going to start getting all the other diseases that are burdening this industry. And since they don't have winter kill anywhere in the Brazilian growing areas, it's only going to be worse for them because they're going to be always there year-round. Next one. One of the things, and this goes back to the strategy that the industry is trying to develop, is we have higher production costs. We have no ability to expand our area plantings by any significance because we run out of land. So what do we do? Well, one of the things we do is focus in on trying to deal with our yield, our disease problems, our pest problems, to try to maximize yield so that we get more production. The other thing we can do is recognize we need to focus in on growing the best quality that we can in the world because the world is not a homogeneous market. There are opportunities to supply substantially higher quality in the world. And that's one of the things that growers are looking at. This is just from Illinois, an example of yields of soybeans versus protein content. We've got the capability to produce select varieties out here that are high yield and also high protein and high oil. And we do that, the rest of the world is going to recognize the U.S. bean as being better, and I can assure you they will in fact pay a premium to come get them. So that's a priority that the industry is focusing on. I think that's my last slide, Mr. Chairman, and just an overview of what's going on in the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bays, and I'm giving us a lot of things to think about now, a lot of food for thought. I think we have a little time. First, I'm going to ask if there's committee members that have questions of any of the presenters that they would like to ask. Anybody?
Can the aphids live on any?
Representative,
I'm sorry.
Lindgren? Representative Lindgren? Who would you and say who you
I are? Really don't know which one to ask. Question is can the aphids live off of any other plant other than the soybean? Doctor?
Good. Well, somebody from the university or research
Kent?
Or who would? Who would?
Sir,
oh,
yeah.
Kent's up here.
Back here. Yeah.
Soybean aphid has a fairly narrow host range, but it does include some of the clovers, for example, red clover is going to be one of the hosts. In terms of woody hosts, which are where it will overwinter, it includes three or four different species of buckthorn. Common buckthorn is the one many of us see in our groves. There's also an ornamental buckthorn, as well as the originally described species in from China, which has been used as a tree break in the clovers. So right now, there is a suspicion that there may be other overwintering sites that we're not aware of, but there's no information one way or another as to what that might be. The concern in the Midwest, though, is that it will feed on other lake yields. Not established to survive on them, but in the case of snap beans, for example, which Minnesota and Wisconsin have a lot of in Illinois, it's transmitting diseases from these lake beans into snap beans. It can't survive in snap beans, so it's taking the disease transfer, and that's threatening the green bean production in the scenario.
The
fortunate thing is that as we get out in the prairie here, we have relatively less frequency of our homes in the winter. And that's still not going to save us.
I'm going to ask Dennis, is there anybody in the audience that would have a specific question for anybody, any of the presenters? Yes.
Well, that's certainly a bottleneck in the life cycle, and so if you could eliminate that, yes, we drastically impact the success of soybean in the United States, and you might force it to overwinter only farmers south. The trouble is that if you go to an acre of woods, so the count done by Rochester, if you go to an acre of woods that's invested, maybe you only have over 2,000 bucks more per
Thank you. Are there any other questions? If not,
Representative Harder.
This would be a question possibly for Mr. Friso from the University, from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. When assertions are made as to beans being resistant or non-resistant to a certain pest or disease, is there federal oversight as to certifying that those claims are legitimate? Or whatever the claim might be regarding special attributes of the seed.
Yes, there is. Under Minnesota seed law, there are requirements. There are basically food and labeling requirements. So if there is an assertion that it has a certain attribute, we do conduct testing to ensure that it's the vaccine. And in addition, it also has to a certain percentage of the seed.
5%
sure of that.
Dr. Oscar?
Brought in a seed that was contaminated at low frequency with some of these viruses, it wouldn't take much to transmit it very quickly. And that would be a big concern for Minnesota seed producers. And I don't know, maybe some of the soybean people or Mr. Friso would have a better idea of, you know, what the current documentation applies on seed sold.
Anybody else wish to comment on that? Mr. Friso?
Representative, there is some testing that is done for certain viruses within seeds and also for seed cases as well. We test for those viruses. Again, we always have the problem of having to know in advance what we're looking for, and if something is new on the horizon that we're not aware of, not being looked for.
Thank you. If there's no further questions, I want to thank everybody for coming. I think after listening to all the presentations that the soybean industry is certainly going to have challenges with the disease and pests and those types of things, but I think also from Mr. Beza's presentation, it should be, it seems that the world market and the demand and for the soybean crop looks like it should be a positive thing for the future. So hopefully we can, between the university and research and different things that some of these problems can be addressed, and that we can continue to have soybeans be a major part of our rural economy in Minnesota. So with that, thank you all for coming, and I hope it was you had some interest in listening to the presentations. And also thank you to all the presenters. With that, meeting adjourned.